Anne and Chet arrived together, both belong to the same center. And hi, Fanny. It is one. Share my screen. Okay, hopefully everybody can see now the 37 practices before them. And we've talked a bit, we've done it different ways, different times. It seems that most people would prefer to chant them all the verses together each week. And today we have a fairly simple verse to discuss. So we're gonna take our time and chant all the verses together. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat, to navigate samsara's endless sea, and set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire. When I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To give up all my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my Dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in Dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade. Kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims. Not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane. Constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Who can the worldly deities protect, themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail? The three jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail. To seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And that completes the seven preliminary practices. Now, the three levels of motivation for Dharma practice. The sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. To strive in all our efforts just for that, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. My mother's each and every sentient being, since time without beginning cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. And now we begin the action bodhicitta verses with the practice that imbues all of the subsequent practices. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone, while focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for others' suffering, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And now what I call bodhisattva boot camp, which is what we're in. We're up to verse 16. If someone driven by intense desire steals all my wealth or instigates the theft, to dedicate to them from all three times my wealth, good deeds, and merit, everything, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Though I've not done the slightest thing that's wrong, without a cause someone cuts off my head, to generate compassion in my heart and take upon myself all their misdeeds, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone slanders me and spreads the word, maligning me throughout the universe, to pay them back, I fill my heart with love, extolling their good traits and character. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone tells a crowd my hidden faults and speaks of me with undisguised contempt, to see them as my spiritual friend and bow to them sincerely with respect, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And we'll chant three times verse 16, which is the one we will be discussing this week. If someone I've cared for as my own child turns on me as their worst enemy, then like a mother when her child is ill, to shower them with more love than before, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone I've cared for as my own child turns on me as their worst enemy, then like a mother when her child is ill, to shower them with more love than before, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone I've cared for as my own child turns on me as their worst enemy, then like a mother when her child is ill, to shower them with more love than before, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So that's where we are. If anybody has anything they would like to share about any way that you have worked with the, especially the boot camp practices, but any of the practices of a bodhisattva while we've been on hiatus, unmute yourself or ask me to do so. And if not, we'll go on. So again, feel free to speak up or get my attention anytime. See, we have a couple of good commentaries to work with this week, and I just wanted to say, I don't know if everybody's had a chance to read my notes on the website, but there are other, this verse talks about the parent-child relationship, which I think any of us who are parents can, you know, relate to, that however our child may behave or however our child may receive our efforts to help them, we never lose touch with love and compassion. It could get obscured a little bit from moment to moment, but that's where we go back to. Our default is love and compassion. And it's a really easy example, I think, to understand, to relate to this verse too, that you're now going to relate to all sentient beings that way as a bodhisattva. But it's not unique to the mother-child or parent-child relationship. I think Dan could possibly have something to share today. He has Clementine's three, right? Two, three, yeah, she's three, right. So he lives this on a daily basis. And any of us, even if our children are adult, I mean, adults are sometimes like the least receptive to our love and compassion and our efforts to be of help. But anyone who also has had a loved one with dementia, or been caring for an ill person, whether it's the flu or whether it's cancer, they are so stressed out by their illness that sometimes they snap at their helpers. They just can't deal with it anymore. In those situations, it's relatively easy to go back to love and compassion, not like, you know, when your boss you know, yells at you or treats you badly, it's like you don't always go back to love and compassion because you don't have it cultivated already for that person. But when it's someone we love and we know they can't help it, it's so easy to see that they just can't help it in those situations. And the other one, you know, is our pets. Same thing. You want to take them to the vet, they run away, they claw us, they try to bite us, you know, and we don't go, oh, I'm done with you, you ungrateful wretch. We go, oh, it's okay. This is really going to help you. I know you don't understand. I have to do it anyway, even though you hate it and you hate me right now for it. But I understand, and my love is so big, it completely encompasses whatever you may do or whatever you may feel in this moment. So those are all examples of what he's trying to do here metaphorically, because he doesn't say a mother and a child, or he says, like, you know, just the same way as a mother or a parent towards their child, we want to cultivate the capacity to include all sentient beings in this default of love and compassion. It ain't easy. Anybody got anything they'd like to say? Kathy, were you trying to get my attention a minute ago, or just kind of moving around? All right. Dan, you got anything to share with us? Not to put you on the spot, you and Clem. He has a just adorable three-year-old child. And he's in Richmond, so I get to see her sometimes. Yeah, he's got nothing. We all know, right? We know what situation's being talked about here. So if nobody has anything to share at this moment, we will turn to Dingo Chenzi Rinpoche, who again has a glorious, and very short this week, a glorious commentary for us with some eye-catching, eye-popping statements in it about what it means to be a bodhisattva. I read, you know, there's Trungpa Rinpoche has a book called The Heart of a Buddha. And I'm not saying you should run out and get it. It is a really good book with a lot of really pivotal, you know, pith teachings in it. But one of them is a chapter on what it means to be a bodhisattva. And the first time I read that, I like ran away in horror. Like, it can't mean that. It can't be that. It can't be that hard. It can't be that, like, accepting of everything. I've read it a few times since then, and it always does strike a little pang of fear in my heart, and also, like, I'm just not living up to that, sorry. But it's an aspiration. Bodhisattvahood is an aspiration. It's an aspiration all the way through the ninth bhumi until you actually cross the finish line. You know, there's always the reason that we're not Buddha yet is we have some resistance. We're just not able to do that yet. It's like, you know, you read about the realized bodhisattvas who, like, you know, somebody comes up to them and says, give me your right arm, and they just cut it off and here, have it. I don't care. I have no attachment to my arm. You know, when we can do that, then when we can, like, eat food we don't like, when we can go to Thanksgiving dinner with our family and never lose touch with love and compassion, and just be receptive to whatever happens and whatever anyone says, then we're sort of, you know, we're starting to get there. And until then, it's just an aspiration, and we must be patient with ourselves. But we always have that touchstone now of knowing. And verse 16 for me is the touchstone. This is my favorite verse. It's the one that's the most vivid to me. There are others, but this one is the one that I really go, okay, I get it. Like, I get what bodhicitta is from this verse. And this is what we want to live up to relate to every sentient being as if they were our most cherished and beloved, can do no ultimate wrong, child or pet or grandmother or, you know, whoever it is. That's what all sentient beings are to us. So anyway, so we will read now Dingo Chenzi Rinpoche's commentary. If you do something good for others, it is a mistake to expect anything in return, or to hope that people will admire you for being a bodhisattva. All such attitudes are a long way from the true motivation of bodhicitta. And in fact, this echoes the very last, the 59th and final slogan in the 7 Points of Mind Training, The Great Path of Awakening, which is a very succinct, don't expect applause. Don't ever expect to get anything back. That's the whole point. That's what makes it bodhisattva. If we expect something back, including gratitude, it's not bodhisattva, it's tit for tat. You know, it's like sort of a transactional interaction. So bodhisattva expects nothing. No applause, no gratitude, you know, a kick in the face is fine, no problem. So that's what Ningbo Chenzi is reminding us of here. He says, not only should you expect nothing in return, you should not be disturbed in the slightest when people respond ungratefully. Oh my God, how often in my life have I been disturbed? Someone for whom you have risked your very life may return your kindness with resentment, hatred, or harm, sometimes in that very moment. But just love him all the more. And Ken MacLeod in Reflections on Silver River has a beautiful contemplation on exactly how we can do this, and we will read that if we have time. A mother with an only child is full of love for that child no matter what he or she does. While she is suckling him, he may bite her nipple and badly wound it. Any moms in the audience, you know, these things happen. But she will never get angry or love him any less. And the same thing with your pet. You know, your pet bites you and, like, maybe you have to go to the hospital and get a drip, you know, if it's a cat. But you don't hate your cat. Whatever happens, she will continue to care for him as best she can. Many people do not have the good fortune that you enjoy, that all of us enjoy, of having met a spiritual teacher, and thus they cannot find their way out of delusion. They need your help and your compassion more than anyone else. So not everybody's trained to be a bodhisattva. Not everybody's heard the words, you know, others first or team other. You know, they don't know. Our default as humans is to be looking out for our own self-interest. Humans, animals, hungry ghosts, everybody. It's like we're looking out for ourselves. So we have to recognize that, like, we may be aspiring to be a bodhisattva, but they may not be. They may be perfectly fine with lashing out ungratefully or, you know, whatever it is that they're doing. So they need your help and your compassion more than anyone else, no matter how badly they may behave. Always remember that people who harm you are simply the victim of their own emotions. Gampopa goes into some detail on this in the Patience chapter of The Ornament of Precious Liberation. There's lots of advice on how to deal with how to react as a bodhisattva when people harm you. It's really, really helpful to review these things. Read the chapter on patience. I read it many, many times in my three-year retreat. We have to be reminded, first thought is, they don't know what they're doing. What Jesus said on the cross, right? Forgive them, Lord, for they know not what they do. They don't know. So just remember that. They don't know. It's the example that's used, I think it's from Shanti Deva, is like if somebody hits you with a stick, you don't blame the stick. And it's the same thing. If someone lashes out on you in anger, you think that it's correct to blame them, but really it's their anger that's the problem. It's not the person that's the problem. It's the anger. They are like the stick of wood being wielded by their anger to hurt you. So this is like 101 is like to go to that one. The other one, which I don't think he's going to mention in this particular chapter, is to remember our karma. If someone's hurting us, we're reaping the karmic result of having acted that way towards someone, perhaps that very person in the past. And those two things, I can tell you, and I've said it many times, I'm sure, in this class alone, these really work. You know, you could have them. These are one of the things you could have tattooed on your arm or have it in a place where you'd see it all the time. Like, remember, don't blame the stick. Remember karma. And it really does dissipate that emotional reaction. It absolutely works. So we go on to think how good it would be if they could be free of these emotions. So we go from our own reaction, we turn to compassion towards them. Oh, I wish I could free them from these emotions that are causing them so much suffering and causing them to engage in actions that are going to cause them suffering in the future through karma. When a thoughtless child wrongs a thoughtful adult, the adult will not feel resentment, but will try with great love to help the child to improve. So now he goes on to how we should appreciate when this happens. To meet someone who really hurts you is to meet a rare and precious treasure. Hold that person in high esteem and make full use of the opportunity to eradicate your defects and make progress on the path. If you cannot yet feel love and compassion for those who treat you badly, it is a sign that your mind has not been fully transformed and that you need to keep working on it with increased application. Again, we're not using this to beat ourselves up. As Westerners, that's what we do. But that's not where we want to go either. We don't want to then turn to blaming ourselves for not reacting like a bodhisattva would react, but we just use it when we recognize it as a reminder. Oh, right, this is what I would do if I were not, you know, if I were not under the sort of control of my own negative emotions. It's my ego clinging. It's my own anger that's making me feel anger toward this person who's harming me. So we just take it as an aspiration and not as a judgment on ourselves that we're not living up to it yet. So it's all win-win. Everything in on the Buddhist path is win-win-win. Somebody is nice to you, wonderful, you're grateful to them. Somebody's mean to you, wonderful, you're grateful to them. Drive all blames into one, be grateful to everybody. Those are like pith slogans in the 7 points of mind training. It's, you could have a positive state of mind no matter what happened. And that's what we're working on. That's like the goal. So last paragraph, a true bodhisattva never hopes for a reward. He responds to the needs of others spontaneously out of his or her natural compassion. Cause and effect are unfailing. Now he does get into karma a little bit. Cause and effect are unfailing, so his actions to benefit others are sure to bear fruit, but he never counts on it. So we don't do beneficial things towards others. We don't put others first in order to reap good karma for ourselves. That kind of defeats the, like it kind of brings this mechanism to a halt. So it's a little bit of a catch-22. He certainly never thinks that people are not showing enough gratitude or that they ought to treat him or her better. But if someone who has done him or her harm later changes his behavior, is set on the path, and achieves liberation, that is something that will make a bodhisattva rejoice wholeheartedly and be totally satisfied. So we take joy in other people's progress on the path, other people's liberation, and so forth. Anybody have any comments or anything to share before we go on to Ken McLeod? Ah, yes, Andy, I will unmute you. You are unmuted.
I see. I just remember a gospel verse from Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers, and it's a common gospel verse that says, no matter what the crime, that mother will say, that child is mine. And I think it's the same thing that's going on that we're talking about here.
Yes.
And I think it's kind of universal. It's not just restricted to Buddhists. I meet a lot of people where I am that are not Buddhists or don't even know what Buddhism is, who actually act really like bodhisattvas.
Yeah.
It's some kind of natural quality.
Yeah.
I really enjoy that.
Yes, yes. Thank you for sharing the gospel verse, which is great. It's exactly the same as what, you know, is the 37 practices, what took me, Zangpo, my brain. But soon I'll be the person with Alzheimer's that everyone will have to, like, you know, forgive when I'm lashing out at you. Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Andy. And I agree, when we've talked about a number of times that bodhisattvas are, like, not exclusive to Buddhism. You don't have to be Buddhist to be, you know, practicing in this way. You don't have to define it as Buddhism. So thank you very much for that reminder. Anybody else? Okay, I'm not seeing anybody. So we will go on to Ken McLeod then. Oh, no, Dan's just adjusting something, I think. All right, verse 16 in Ken McLeod, and this is Reflections on Silver River. And again, it's called that because Silver River was where Pope Maisonko lived, spent the last 20 years of his life on Silver River, on Moultrie, which is another of Pope Maisonko's names. Moultrie means Silver River. So it's kind of a little bit of a play on words, reflections on Silver River. And he has, I'll read you his translation of this. Even if a person you have cared for as your own child treats you as her worst enemy, lavish her with loving attention like a mother caring for her ill child. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So I'm just going to read excerpts from this one. So he says, except for the loss of a child, perhaps the greatest pain a parent can know is the pain that arises when her child turns on her and sees her as an enemy. It's a bad feeling. That's happened to all of us, whether we're mothers or not. It's happened to all of us. And he goes on to quote Shakespeare, as Shakespeare's King Lear laments, how sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child. So he says, if you have ever nurtured, and again, he opens it up too, it's not just about the parent-child relationship. If you have ever nurtured, nourished, guided, taught, or mentored someone who later turned on you, you know something of this pain. Kindness given is not always returned. Let's contemplate that for a moment. Maybe we can think of times when we were kind to someone and it was misinterpreted or just not returned for whatever reason. Maybe we can think of a time when someone was kind to us and we regret that we were not kind to them in return. I can think of a few of those too, especially when one is young. So it's just a fact. He's just presenting it here as a fact of life. Kindness given is not always returned. When it comes back as anger, aggression, or betrayal, it is like a physical blow. Your heart cracks as waves of disbelief wash through you. Other feelings slowly register: denial, anger, despair, hurt. So he says we should give up the idea, like the expectation of anything else. Like, this is just what's happening. This is the way it's unfolding. And that's like the first rule of Buddhism, is whatever's happening is happening. You know, if we resist it, suffering. If we try to make it different, suffering. If we try to escape it, suffering. So the only way to sort of make it better is to accept it. Again, it doesn't mean we have to accept like people causing harm in like actively causing harm. We can intervene in actions that other people are engaged in towards us or towards anybody else if we see that actual harm is being caused. The point here is we don't have to do it in an emotional way. We can do it from the point of view of accepting that this is what's happening right now. I simply have to intervene and, you know, grab the person's arm with my hand so that they can't hit the other person or, you know, or me or whatever it is. But you can do that without anger, and that's what we're cultivating. The ability to know when to act and to be able to do it with a completely clear mind. So he says, instead of like turning all your expectations over and over in your head and getting yourself all worked out, which is what we normally do, instead relate to the pain that is clearly there. Be awake in and to what is happening. And here's the meditation. I mean, I think this is so beautiful. Take in the pain, and he's using the feminine here. If it were the masculine, I, you know, might be less likely to point it out. But, it, you know, or I would say him or her. We're going to just leave it as it is, and it's going to be her. Take in the pain that she is feeling. So, like, that's a step right there. Like, let's just pause, and maybe we can think of a situation when this has happened to us. Bring it to mind, whether it's a pet, you know, afraid to go to the vet or get a shot or a pill, or whether it's a child, or whether it's a person with dementia or a person with cancer, or just an angry person. Take in the pain that they're feeling. Step number one. And you can even do that as taking and sending. Like, just breathe it in. you know, our sort of habitual reaction is to run away from it or to deflect it. As bodhisattvas, we breathe it in. And we could even think, breathe it in and take it away from that person. But for now, just take in the pain that this person is feeling. If you could just pause and do that, like that automatically de-escalates the situation quite a bit right there, like 70% de-escalation. So take it into the pain that you are feeling. So we don't have to pretend that we're not feeling anything. We don't have, like, it's not wrong if we're feeling angry or we're feeling upset or distressed. We can, like, that's how it is too. That's part of, like, the reality of the situation. So we take in the pain that the other person's feeling and we take it into the pain that we're feeling without flinching away from any of it. Take in her anger. Take it into your anger. Feel your anger. And feel any hurt, pain, or sadness associated with it. Whatever the emotion is you're feeling, feel it. And take their pain into it too. Take in the anger of all beings everywhere into your anger, or the hurt of all beings everywhere into your hurt. Send out the love and care that you have given in the past to this person. So first thing, we have to connect with their pain and just be there with it. Second thing, we have to connect with our pain, just be there with it, and we let those two things mix. And now third step is that we remember, we reconnect with our love and compassion for that person. So these are three distinct things that we're doing. And if you go into a situation and you don't, like, it is the first thing that happens is we get very confused sometimes. And it takes a while to sort it out. So this would be a way that we could unpack it in the moment if we had the presence of mind. Like, okay, they're really upset. Take a deep breath. I'm really upset. Take a deep breath. This person and I have had a great relationship in the past. They did this wonderful, they sent me flowers on my birthday. They always remember my birthday. Remember that. Like, for me, that's key, is keeping a list of nice things people have done for me so that when they do something that upsets me, I can look at the list and go, oh, right, they always remember my birthday. Or if it's your child or your pet, you go back to that feeling of caring for them. The person with cancer, you just go back to that feeling of all the care that you have felt for them up until this moment when this thing is happening. So, going back to reread that sentence. Send out the love and care you have given in the past. So first we connect with it, then we send it out. So again, invoking, taking, and sending, breathing in their pain, breathing it into our pain, inviting the pain of all sentient beings into that pain. So that's the taking part. And then the sending part is reconnecting with our love and care for the person and their kindness to us in the past. Sending it back to them. Send it out again and again. So we don't have to just do this once. We keep doing it, lather, rinse, repeat, right? And it may even be the three-step sequence, like, okay, you send them out some love and then wham, you know, you're smack in the middle of the pain again, or they're still lashing out at you. Take in their pain again, recognize your pain again, take in everybody's pain again, and then back to your love and compassion for them and keep sending it out. And then the beautiful part, send it out magnified 100, 1,000, a million times. And that's what the original verse says, is send out even more love. Love them even more when they're not grateful to you, when they're angry, when they're returning your kindness with anger. Increase, like ratchet up your kindness, ratchet up your love and compassion. Send it out magnified 100, 1,000, a million times. And now another step is step four, probably step, I think it's step five. Open your heart to everyone who is hurt, angry, or confused, and take in all their suffering, whatever form it takes. So this is like that last step when we do the taking and sending exercise in the Two Wings of Awakening. It's like we've done people we love, we've done people we don't know, and we've done people who are giving us a hard time. And now we just extend it to all sentient beings. So even in this moment, when we're dealing with this person who's being ungrateful to us, we can include all sentient beings if we have the presence of mind to do that. If we remember, take in all their suffering, whatever form it takes, and send out your care, your love, your well-being and understanding. Give everything away. So we turn every insult, every injury into an opportunity to remember all sentient beings, that suffering, like the first noble truth, suffering is just the way things are because we're confused. And we reconnect. We use that, it becomes, well, I may have mentioned this before, but I think Mingyur Rinpoche in one of his books tells us that, you know, he underwent some of the testing they do, the neurological testing of people who've meditated for a billion hours, and he was one of the test subjects. And he said that, like for most people, like people who've not meditated 10,000 hours or whatever, especially on compassion, if they hear a baby, if somebody plays for them a baby crying, their first reaction is irritation. But for someone who has spent their life cultivating compassion on purpose, the first reaction is actually compassion. You hear a baby crying and you go straight to compassion. For most of us, that it may be like the second or the third wave. You know, we may have to consciously bring ourselves to the compassion thing. But if you do it for 10,000 hours, then it comes up naturally. So that's bodhisattva training. So anyway, I think this paragraph is just so beautiful. Everything we need to know about how to apply taking and sending in this particular circumstance, and any kind of adversity or anyone harming us in any way, we could use this. So to read a little bit more of what Ken says, I'm not reading the whole thing. He says, you, just as you are right now, have the potential to experience whatever life throws at you, even the ingratitude of your child or your mother with dementia or your friend with cancer or your pet. Rest in that clarity, like the clarity of knowing that. That's what clarity is. You know, the mind is made up of three aspects, emptiness, which is the spaciousness, the knowing that there's always more, like that nothing is in itself a certain way, and that there's always more to any situation or any person than we are perceiving in this moment. That's the emptiness. The clarity is really the capacity to know, the capacity to be aware. So here what we're being aware of is that we can take anything. No matter what life throws at us, we can take it and we can turn it around into the bodhisattva path. So rest in that clarity and continue to practice taking and sending, mixing awareness with your life and letting go of ideas, beliefs, stories, or agendas. And again, it's another sort of pet observation of mine, is that most of the time we, including myself, live in our concepts about things. We are not seeing things the way they are. We are seeing things through our judgments. Just try to have a conversation with someone who has a different political belief, you know, and then you see very clearly how stuck you are in certain concepts, which don't seem like concepts. It seems like you're seeing things the way they are and the other person is not seeing things the way they are. And if you could just say the right thing, they would see you, it would clear up and they would see things the way they are, which is the way you see things. They think the same thing. And there is no, like, ultimate, as Sita Rinpoche has said, there's no ultimate relative. Relative reality is all confusion. None of it is correct. It's just not right. All of it is seen through different filters. And those filters are what we call stains or confusion. So the single most helpful thing to me in any situation is to recognize what I'm coming into it with. Like, what here is just my opinion? You know, what is my, like, certainty that things are this way? What percentage of that is actually my filter, like, of some opinion, deep-seated opinion or judgment about something? Maybe parsnips taste really good, you know? Anyway, rest in that clarity and continue to practice taking and sending no matter what happens. mixing awareness with your life, that means we're always trying to operate from awareness. And we don't most of the time. Like even me, as much as I try to practice it, I find myself unconscious like quite a lot of the time. And I have to, suddenly something will bring me to it. And I'm like, oh, right. Yes, I've been on autopilot. But I should be like mindfully present in this moment. And we try to string them together and make it every moment. So we try to mix awareness with our life. We try to apply taking and sending no matter what's happening. And we try to always recognize our ideas, our beliefs, our stories, and our agendas, and try to see things without that filter. Try to look through those filters. Let those filters sort of subside a bit and just be with things as they are. Oh, so I have a note to myself to read this through to the end now. So he goes on to say, anger can then be understood, like approaching life like this, anger can then be understood as an expression of a natural intelligence telling you that a line has been crossed. So often, he's saying that our reaction is not completely invalid, like it's giving us information, but our mind, our untrained mind, tends to run amok with the emotional reaction, and we just find ourselves caught up in an unconscious way in that. But if we can let go of that, like sort of hyper emotionality, we start to see that there's some valid information here. Like, yes, this person did something that is not okay. This person said something that's really not okay, or that's harmful, or they're doing something that's harmful. And that's what we want to zero in on with our clear mind. So in this case, her anger points to a line in her. She feels some line has been crossed, whether objectively that's true or not. Your anger points to a line in you. You may not know the line in her. You may not even know the line in you, but those lines are there. When you practice this way, your actions are not dictated by anger, whether as persecutor or victim. You may reset a boundary. You know, it may be telling you you need to reset a boundary. You may extend a helping hand. It may be telling you that they need help. You may do nothing. You know, when you see clearly without the clouds of emotionality, you may see that the best thing to do is not to do anything, to walk away or just to stay and just be present, not to try to react in some active way. Whatever you do, your action comes from clarity, from meeting and embracing the totality of your experience, internal and external. Here, compassion is not a method or a means to an end, but a result. The result of being awake and present with the pain in you, in the other, and in the world. Awakeness automatically results in compassion. That's like the definition of a Buddha. Someone who's completely awake is also completely compassionate. If you feel a, okay, and this is kind of an interesting paragraph right at the end. If you feel a compulsion to express your care and concern, be careful. You know, you may want to reiterate or remind them, I'm your mom, I'm only trying to do what's best for you and you just can't see it yet. I mean, you don't even try with your pet, right? You might say the words, but you know they're not really going to get it. If you feel a compulsion to sort of explain yourself, be careful. Unwanted attention can also cross a line. Do just what needs to be done, no more, no less. So that requires a pretty awake mind, I think, and we're all working on that. So that's Ken McLeod. So anybody have anything that they would like to say? We have 15 minutes left. Yes, Angela, I'm going to unmute you.
I really think this is helpful for people who are also abusive, because I was in an abusive relationship. So me being able to react this way, because I had lots of practice, it deflated their situation to be able to do that to me, because I did not react in those old patterns of trying to protect myself or my boundaries and just allow them to do that and then discuss what I needed to discuss and sort of okay, that's your anger, sure, but we're doing this now. And so it was really useful and practical in a situation, even with an adult that just really wants to get you upset.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I think there's like, I think we've talked a little bit before about like the cycle that like someone coming at you in an angry way, they're counting on you responding the same way because it feeds energy. Like there's some kind of energy that's looking to be released here. And when we don't react with anger, and I have had some experience with this, when we don't react with anger, but we always react either neutrally or with sort of kindness, they don't know what to do because the energy, like suddenly they're stuck with all this energy and like they have to look at it. And it doesn't tend to resolve, in my experience, it doesn't resolve itself in that moment. It can be quite upsetting to the other person. But over time, it kind of makes it, it has an impact. So it sounds like in your case, Angela, it did have some good results.
Well, they weren't getting the result that they wanted, so they just had to resort to talking about what their problem was and not trying to incite anger for power. And so that was really good to kind of claim that power back for myself and just to give them the power not to have that situation. Mm-hmm. They can have a problem. They don't need to overtake someone or try to overtake someone by making them angry. It's not helping for them either.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. Anybody else have anything that they would like to say? John, you're unmuted.
Okay, well, it's more of a general one than a specific to this verse where it's a person doing something. In my recent experience, on my way back from my trip, I got caught in a snowstorm. My bus canceled 3 times. I had to rebook my hotel, the whole shebang there. And good time to practice. But it says here that they should not be disturbed in the slightest. Well, I didn't find me being emotionally disturbed, but there were plenty of thoughts that jumped in and seemed like they wanted to disturb me. So how do you deal with this, and what is the relationship with those thoughts and emotions?
Well, I think it's the same thing. You know, whatever it is that's hitting us in the face at any given moment, it's going to bring up a reaction. So our job as practitioners, I'm just going to mute you because there's a noise. Our job as practitioners is, what's our first job? Like, what's the first, let's everybody think about that for a minute. What's our first job as a practitioner when we feel, you know, thought chain or an emotional reaction coming up in us? Is to recognize it. It's like to be able to say, oh, I'm starting to feel angry, or, oh, this situation is stressful. And I don't know if I may not be describing, you know, what you're talking about exactly, John, but for a lot of us, that's how it would feel, I think. And just recognizing it takes you out of it. You've already disidentified from it. And that's like 50% right there. It's just the recognition. You're not necessarily going to be able to get rid of the jangly feeling or the emotionality, but recognizing it is very helpful. And then you can apply whatever remedy seems most useful at that time. And as we've discussed, it tends to fall, at least in this, you know, the mind training texts, it tends to fall into 2 categories. One is the love and compassion side of it, where we can do taking and sending for it, which you can do for yourself. You can do for everybody who's in the same situation, you whatever. You just find a way to arouse love and compassion, which pushes out the other stuff because they can't coexist. They can go back and forth, but they can't exist at the same time. The other way is to just look at it. Like that's the emptiness way, is we just look directly at that stress or that emotion and we go, does it have a shape? Does it have a color? Where is it? And by the time we've gotten to the second or the third question, it's like we've disengaged ourselves quite a distance by then from being in the middle of it. And we see, we can't locate it. It doesn't have any characteristics. It's not really a thing. And we just rest in that. That's a way of bringing our mind to rest. So you're looking for that. You're looking for a way to bring your mind to rest in the midst of whatever's happening. So does that help, or do you want to follow that up?
I wasn't getting emotional about it, but it's like thoughts now popping in saying, all right, now I got to worry about how I'm going to, change this, and then how I'm going to do that. Yeah. Now it's all these thoughts that weren't like there a minute ago, but they're not emotion, and I don't have any desire to, get mad or angry or upset or anything. It's just that it just floods up there. So you just got to watch them. And then, as you said, try to find a way to rest in them.
Okay. Yeah, just recognize. And then you have to sort out which thoughts are actually useful and which ones are just storyline, which ones are just mucking up the picture, and which ones are, are like, I have to do this, and then I have to do that. And then once you've isolated those, you've identified like the actual action plan, like what needs to be done, then you can let everything else, like it can bubble up as much as it wants to. If you're not engaging with it, if you're not getting sucked into it, then doesn't matter. We're never trying to make our minds a way that they're not. We're never trying to suppress like an emotional reaction. We're trying to recognize it and apply whatever remedy we need, if we need a remedy. And in your case, in the case of what you're describing, it sounds like maybe not even a remedy is needed, other than recognize what you need to do, recognize what's like just extra commotion, and just rest in whatever is there, whether it's commotion or things that need to be done. Anybody else got anything, question or thing to share? Marilyn. Okay, you're unmuted.
This is sort of comes up again and again for me, and it clearly is the patterns, like the verse number two, that I should be leaving. But a lot of times these things, I feel like I'm hit in the head, I'm just so totally surprised by what's coming at me. And that's what is really hard for me to deal with, to get that awareness bit. Yes, I meditate every morning. That should mean that I can make a space between my anger, and whatever else I'm feeling. And it's just so hard in some circumstances to have that space.
Yeah. I think you speak for many, if not all of us. And I mean, it happens to me on a daily basis. Like I have to go, okay, what's going on here? If I catch myself, and sometimes I catch myself like way later. It's like, okay, what was that? And then that's when you pick it apart. You go, okay, this is what was happening, and this is what was necessary, and this is what I might have done that would have made it better. And, you live and learn. It's a process. The meditating every morning is a huge, huge step towards being able to apply these things in real life. But it really is like a sudden smack on the head. A lot of what happens to us, we're not expecting the particular thing. So recognition that's the key. And it's the hardest part. It's just recognizing something's happening that we need to recognize. So anybody else have anything? Marilyn, did you have any further follow-up on that? Okay. Anybody else have anything? We have 5 minutes left. Deidre, I'm unmuting you. Okay.
This kind of goes to what Marilyn was saying. One of the things that I find is that I think we feel like we have to react to things very quickly, because that's a sign of intelligence. Mm-hmm. People that can fire off very quick, smart things off the top of their head, we're kind of impressed with. But, I spent a little time in the Appalachians, and I noticed the people there, when you say something, they actually ponder what you said before replying or saying something back. And I felt like such a klutz around them because they were so wonderful. I mean, they had the most amazing listening ability. They really heard what people were saying, not just the words, but what their intention was, because they spent that little bit of time actually pondering what was said. And so so I kind of had used that technique with a lot of emotions, not just anger, but many things. And then the other thing is that for me, I have like a very, I think, strong survival instinct. So I get adrenaline really easily. So as soon as I feel that adrenaline, I'm like, whoa, whoa.
Well, that's actually a way to recognize. That's a real key. Thank you for bringing that up, because that's a real key to recognize something's going on in your body. Like,
and
what
is when this? I feel that, I've been known to say, I don't trust how I'm feeling right now, so I don't want to talk anymore about this. And then I just kind of back off and just give it some space. Because it's like there's no grading system for how fast we need to respond to anything.
Yeah. I think that's why in our culture we have the idea of count to 10. You know, we all learned that when we were kids.
Yeah.
Give yourself some space before you react. But as you're pointing out, like with our sort of modern urban sensibility, it's all about witty repartee and being on the spot and all that. But one thing that comes to my mind often, actually, is some advice that Yeshe Jamtso, the translator, gave to Jamdren, the translator, many, many years ago when she was first starting translating. And he was at something and she was translating. And he later took her aside and said, you know, you don't have to start right away. You can pause. And I've noticed that a lot of the better, really good translators, and Jamdren is one of those, and she does that now too, they take a moment, like, to let it sink in what they heard. But when you're starting, your first impulse has got to get out there. You know, people are going to think I'm stupid, or they're going to think I didn't get it. Give yourself a moment. And I think it's better received than we might think. I learned that, you know, when I was on sort of public relations for the monastery. And, you know, I've done that job for other people too. It's like, can I get back to you on that? You know, don't you blurt out. If you blurt out, like if you have to answer something right on the spot, they're going to pick out the stupidest thing that you said, and that's going to be the headline. So it's like, can I get back to you? Could I email you about that? Giving yourself some space. So recognize, number one, give yourself some space, number two, I think would be a good good rule of thumb. Yes, Joanne, I'm going to unmute you.
Minute or 2 minutes. I just have to add that, yes, I believe in resilience and self-reliance, but there's an aspect of interdependence. In other words, when we connect with others, other precious human beings, it really is very exhilarating. I mean, that short visit in New York, in October, getting into the urban life with my son, Christopher, traveling the subways, being lost, but then commuters, people that are weary from a full day's work, extending themselves and helping. And that went so, and it was the anonymity of urban life just dissipated. Everyone was there for each other. So I have to add that there is hope out in society.
Yes, thank you. Yes, and I think the Bodhisattva path is about that. It's about connecting in a positive way, no matter what's happening. Looking for that positive human connection, that namaste, you know, I recognize the Buddha nature in you, you know, no matter what's going on. Thank you for sharing that. I'm glad you got to go and visit Christopher in New York.
I love it. Thank you. it's a great session, and I really appreciate the invitation.
Great. Thank you. I'm glad you could join us, Joanne. All right. Anybody else? It's actually 2:30. I guess we should stop here and do the dedication. I have a couple of little notes, but we'll do the dedication first in case anybody has to leave. So we're on the prayer sheet again, which I will send to those who don't have it, doing the four verses of dedication of merit. Let me make sure we're muted. Okay. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, from Tu Zangpo and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Bodhudakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha. This dedication, please fulfill. Okay, we'll take a moment to bring our minds to rest again, just resting in open awareness, receptive to everything.